Don Hardy with Berger ABAM. And for Leslie and all the folks in the audience, she's going to try to pick up your names. So if you guys would like to do introductions real quick from the back. Steve, would you like to start?
Yeah. Steve Matz, Navajo Construction.
John Girard, Quail Homes.
Rod Swanson, Clark County Public Works.
Jason Lees, SGA Engineering.
Kelly Schinners, SGA Engineering.
Good, Dave.
And just wanted to welcome Mike to the board. And Mike, I just wanted to ask if you could give us just a brief bio for the group.
Sure. So I'm Mike Nieto. Owner of CatWorks Construction. I've been around about 12 years now. I'm originally from the other Clark County, Las Vegas, Nevada. And when I first moved up here, I thought people said that there was a boom going up here, but I told them they hadn't seen a boom yet. So anyway, it's really neat to be up here, working and been up here for about 20 years. Really enjoy Vancouver and Clark County. We do a lot of work, private and federal, and just try to do our best to be good stewards in the community, and this was a good opportunity for me to learn more about what's going on for our future and hopefully be of help to.
Thank you.
You bet.
Just a note, we're recording this Engineering Advisory Board meeting. If you have a cell phone on, if you please turn that off, appreciate that. And we're welcoming Aki through as well, just to, for the record. Why don't we go ahead and we'll go through the review and adoption of meeting minutes from July, since we did not have a meeting in August. So,
Mr. Chair, I've reviewed and I move to approve.
Seconded.
Seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Next item is upcoming events, Greg.
Upcoming events, so you'll see that on the back page of your agenda. And we start with our Board of County Councilors work sessions and hearings. Have a rather busy month coming up in September. The first of those to announce is our usual work session. Those can start as early as 9 a.m. You'll want to check the councilors' grid webpage for exact times and events with the work sessions. They also will typically hold their hearings every Tuesday, 10 a.m., with the exception of first Tuesday of the month. That's usually an evening meeting at 6 p.m. And then specific hearings that are currently scheduled on September the 6th, 6:30 p.m. Marty, I presume you're leading that up. Community Development Preliminary Final Review and Building Fees and Extending Land Use Approval. We have a work session on a road vacation, Lower River Road approval, Wednesday, September 7th, 11 a.m. in the morning. A work session on park impact fees, Tuesday, September 13th, 2 p.m. And then finally, on September the 20th, 10 a.m., we have a hearing on the, it looks like a revisit on the fees and extending the land use approval. So. Following with the Planning Commission work sessions and hearings in September, the first of those is this evening at 5:30. I hope we're out by then. Amend Clark County Code 40.610 to provide an option for deferral of collection of impact fees for single-family housing units. A hearing on September 15th at 6:30. To consider staff recommendations to amend Clark County Code 40.610. And then that looks like it's it for the Planning Commission, so.
Any board member announcements?
I have one. I do have to leave early, so I apologize in advance. So I'm gonna be here through agenda item 2, and then after that we're actually sponsoring an event tonight. And I should probably be there.
And then, Don, I did email the board members about an item that I'd like to bring to the attention, and that's what they handed out.
And that's regarding the four zones and planning?
That is correct.
And I think that we can add that into the agenda items. I'd like to do that after Susan Wilson's presentation. And I do have one announcement. Jeff is going to cover for me in October. I'm going to be visiting my daughter in Orlando. She just got a job there at Disney World, so we're going to be back visiting her. So thank you. Going to the next item, but I guess before we get to that, there's a lot of folks here just want to recognize that. Yes,
can
yes, please.
Can I just speak up a little bit?
Sure, okay.
Because we don't have
mic. Absolutely, sorry, I'll do the best I can. So recognizing that we have a lot of folks here, we do have a place at the end for public comments, but I think also a lot of folks probably are here for some of these items that will be discussed by the board, and perhaps some of that discussion will help shed some light on direction for that and next steps, is my hope. So there's an opportunity at the end to speak, so if folks want to speak at the end of this, they'll be welcome to do so.
Just to suggest, if it is related to that item,
yes.
I wonder if we can have a short, maybe limited to like 15 minutes before we go to the end, before we do the check. Just a suggestion.
Sure.
And I know other people are here for that and they have to leave as well. So.
Is Susan here? Susan Wilson?
She knows not to come till about 3:15.
Okay, I'm just trying to recognize her slot, but I guess I think we're good. Eric can go until that, if we can leave that in.
Okay.
That'd be great.
We'll see how it works.
Yeah, let's do that. So, stormwater code.
I'll take this one. I think everyone is generally quite familiar with the context of it, but just to summarize on that, our Clean Water Group headed up responding to the Department of Ecology code additions and revisions, and that work was done and put into place at the beginning of the year. So in effect, we've got about 8 months experience now with the new code requirements upon us. And there's a very significant area of concerns, particularly in the single family residence, which trigger the code requirements 1-9 on that. So that's what we thought we would start to focus on today. A number of our departments are getting calls and concerns on this. I know, Marty, your group's taking calls, development engineering. Of course, we're taking calls at both staff and management level. Our clean water group's taking calls. And, of course, not last or least, is our Board of County Councilors are taking calls on this. That led to a meeting a few weeks ago with an applicant, and Councilor Olson led that meeting up, and one of the results of that meeting, we thought it would be good to bring this as a topic item into the Deed Council, and just if nothing else, begin to start to discuss this, hear from concerns that our applicants have with this, get your input, get your ideas. One thing that comes to see if we can what we can do to provide some help or relief or clarification efficiencies in our practices or procedures, or a less demanding or onerous or costly process is what we're looking for here. So not exactly, but similar to this, we faced this when our stormwater inspection fees went into place a couple of years ago. We did form a subcommittee out of DEEB out of that, took a close look at it, and it was primarily, if you don't mind me putting it this way, but kind of the little guy that was getting hurt the worst on this, and I think we had a good response out of DEEB to that, where we were able to find some relief to smaller developments in that regard. So perhaps this is something like that. Again, we're at the newer stages, but not too new to realize that we do have some significant concerns and that we ought to devote some time to start to talk about that. So with that, I guess we'll just open to any thoughts or ideas or recommendations you may have. And then secondly, I would just pose to Deeb, is this something that we also want to follow up and at least formulate a subcommittee to take any recommendations that come out of our discussion today and then start to get to work on that. So with that, we'll open it up for comment.
So just a little more background. The BIA's office has been running off the hook on the issue. And one of the biggest immediate topics has been the soil amendment requirement that, you know, it's been around for a little bit, but it was enforced basically just recently. There was some notice getting out, but it still caught a lot of builders by surprise. So I know there was a meeting a few days ago. There was kind of a training session for the builders, and I think a lot of them heard about it there. They've had a lot of concern, and you know, this board here was put together as a constructive way to have solutions between the community and between the building community and Clark County staff and administration. So that's the suggestion that they've been giving out is that, you know what, this got moved up on the agenda and we can start dealing with this. This is not a complaint session. This just to kind of, for all people on the audience, it's not a complaint session. We're here to try to find solutions and to work with staff to find something that works for everybody. And just to preface that, a lot of the stuff comes from the Department of Ecology. So we can do only so much as a county. But I think we've come up, I had our staff look at what's the low-hanging fruit, what are we doing now that's above and beyond what ecology might be requiring, and where do we have room to work, where we can make it a little simpler on the small guys, the builders, this is having a huge impact on them. So a little more background.
And I would like to echo Eric's concerns. I've heard it from several of the home builders going through other home builders talk to BIA about this particular concern, really, again, is this soil amendment issue. And while there's a recognition that it's been on the books for some while, forced by ecology down through the permit into the code, it caught a lot of people off guard in terms of the county now starting to implement that and doing it what was perceived at a sudden pace. To the extent we're here to try to offer up some solutions to that, you know, one of the concerns I have is making sure that we're still recognizing vested projects and vested rights. BIA has been pretty instrumental in defending a case and winning a case at the Court of Appeals that the stormwater is a vestable item under planning use permits and that is continuing on right now. But beyond that, I think that there's been some desire on some builders' parts maybe to partake in a demonstration project with the county to demonstrate whether or not this technique is actually effective or not in the county given the soil conditions that we're dealing with. So to that I'll yield the floor. I think Jeff had something to say.
Yeah, I was actually one of the builders that offered up some homes, lots, whatever you want to call it, as a test. Really, not just for the, you know, how this works, but or does it work actually? But how it works. Part of our concern, and I think of the fear in a lot of the home builders, is we're concerned whether we can meet the standards, whether we can do soil amendments in the winter, how the testing work. What you know, this is an experimental type of project to actually see what works, what doesn't work, what's economical, what's not economical. So I offered up that Kingston would be willing to, you know, throw in some lots. Newtrad would be willing, Pacific Light would be willing, Cascade West would be willing. I stopped there. I'm sure others would be willing to throw in a few lots and have this done. It's my understanding you have one inspector, I think, that's going to be doing the testing and trying to figure this all out. And I just think it's going to, when this hits, it's going to hit hard, it's going to hit fast, and the county's going to be buried, we're going to be buried. And at the end of the day, we're not going to know what works or doesn't work, which is the whole point of the ordinance and what the DOE is trying to accomplish. So I don't know, from a technical standpoint, all I'm hearing is people are concerned that we can't even do this, or if this doesn't make sense, or you know, we've got negative consequences on the outside, or the, you know, on the other end. So I thought like some kind of a pilot program or rollout would be something that might satisfy risk management from the county standpoint and the DOE and work to see what works and doesn't work. So
very quickly, the last time the county worked with DOE on a stipulated agreement, there was an appeal and Ecology did a 180. So we have to be mindful of working with Ecology in good faith about piloting a standard that they've imposed on the county. So we do have some risk management issues and legal issues that we have to be mindful of.
It's an interesting issue, though, because it's a moving target. And I was talking to a big landscaper yesterday, a landscaping company. So they've got landscaping companies that are looking at how they can make this work. And then there's talk about there's a bio something soil out there that's almost like a slurry that can be, maybe put on and then tilled in. And that might meet the standards, but we don't know. So I'm willing to spend some money to figure that out, and maybe some other home builders are, but why put it on the masses until we figure out what works and doesn't work? I'm not sure what the inspector is going to be looking for. I'm not sure the inspector knows what the inspector is going to be looking for. I think she may still be, by her own words, and that's, I'm hearing that third hand, so I want to, but it's a moving target is what I'm hearing.
Chair Harney.
Yes.
Would you take a minute just to explain what the exact issue and standard is?
And I was thinking the same thing, and I'm going to defer this to Greg. I think some parameters for this would be good, because it's a topic that I'm not super familiar with. And I think also to Jeff's point, when is this all going to take place? Which I think is the pilot program, if it actually can be successful, if that was one option, when is that going to happen? So, Greg, if you would mind.
I think I'm going to toss to Ollie here. He's much, much more technically versed on it, so.
Yeah, the code requires soil amendment for 6 inches, over the area that has been disturbed on site, whether it's a small lot or a large lot. Any area that has been disturbed outside of the building footprint needs to have that 8 inches of soil amendment, which is a special kind of soil mix. So that's the issue, and that needs to be done. I don't know when they look at it to be done, but I think prior to occupancy would be fine, prior to leaving the site and approving the whole site. I'm sorry, go ahead.
But just the purpose being to achieve a certain infiltration, right?
Yeah, first of all, that the soil absorbs a lot of water and reduces the runoff outside, and it provides some relief from the peak flows to get into the system.
Yep.
So it slows down the flow coming off the site.
Sorry, I have another bit of clarification. So it's 8 inches of amendment, it's not 2 inches or 3 inches tilled into an 8 inch.
There's tilling below that.
I'm sorry?
There is tilling below that. You have to till it first, right, and then 8 inches of amendment.
And then mix it all in or set it on?
Well, the till just basically.
So it breaks the soil interface.
So you don't have to pack
the soil. It's
8 inches over the entire disturbance.
And you can compact it with a roller. Hand roller, which only compacts about 1 to 3 inches.
You don't want to compact it.
I'm throwing this out because you're not.
It needs to be a sponge. Yeah.
Go ahead, Dean.
Dean Schatz with Public Works Construction Inspection. We talk a lot about individual homes, which is important, but it's these BMPs that are being imposed on developments change the way developments are constructed. You cannot go about reconstruction in the traditional manner that we have in the past. And you'll see that a lot of individual lots as well. We've had to take some of the developments that we have had recently and have pre-construction units on site with geotechs, and the contractor to basically develop a process that's going to work well for an individual site. And it's going to be different from site to site. So if you do have a soil amendment, that will very likely be some of the last work we are to finish your work, because it can't be very heavily compacted. You may have to go through to all that after the fact. This is a totally different approach, and we're seeing it on the larger scale on developments, and it's definitely going to impact individual lives. This is an overall change of where we're going to work.
What Dean's saying is right. It's part of low impact development techniques. So it's a BMP called Soil Quality in Depth, and it's something that you look at either the mandatory LID came through in the last code change. One thing I want to stress is I think the low hanging fruit here that we could do probably immediately to provide some relief, and it's kind of what Jeff said, we should phase this in. Well, it's meant to be phased in because this requirement is part of the mandatory LID that only applies to projects under 40.386. It doesn't apply to an existing development where you have an existing lot that has an approved stormwater plan. When we look at a subdivision as a whole, you're looking at it, you know, you're modeling it with a different soil type if you're using amended soil. So if you're using amended soil, you model it differently than if you're using compacted ground. Well, those old projects, the ones that you guys are building in most of these subdivisions, were not modeled with low impact development soil. They weren't modeled with amended soil. They were modeled with regular lawn. So if that's the case, we should be applying this, but it naturally rolls out. It rolls out as new projects are approved and they get a new pre-app. And I think a lot of the confusion, and I think it's among staff and everyone, is that, well, they're applying this to existing lots in subdivisions, which it really shouldn't apply to yet. The ones that get impacted the most by this are ones that did not have an approved stormwater plan. If you're in a rural area and you're disturbing 5 acres, then you gotta look at a different technique altogether. And there's other things I think we can do for relief there, but for the soil quality and depth, we have to look at not disturbing as much of the site. Kind of what Dean mentioned, it's a little different. Instead of just coming in and clearing and mass grading everything, you need to look at locating the site. This is a requirement from the state, it's not the county. So, you know, they're not the bad guys here, they're just enforcing it. But we can be smarter as a development community, and then we need to make sure staff is interpreting it correctly and only applying it to the jobs where they have to apply it to. So I think that's the low-hanging fruit. I think that's something we could do even today, is make sure that the policy is that this doesn't apply unless you are under and not vested with something else before 40.386. And I think that's a pretty clear one. I think there's a lot of miscommunication regarding that. And that could have a huge impact on a lot of at least the builders in subdivisions. And it is going to slowly roll out because those lots are going to be gone. And anything new that goes under 40.386, we're going to have to address it with the soil amendment. There's two ways, however, and this is my number two item, is you either have, if you're not vested, then you have the performance standard. There's two ways to meet the low impact development standard. There's either you go through the mandatory list. On the mandatory list, number one is soil quality and depth. If you choose not to do the mandatory list and you go to the performance standard, you can show that you meet the same target by using any other BMP you like. And I'll use an example. So what you're worried about is not having runoff leave the site. If we're out on East County and we have gravelly soils, amending the soil is beyond what needs to be done to meet the performance standard. Because what we can do is we can use bioretention, we can use something else, and then we have infiltration out there. We're in a great situation. Now, you're not going to be able to do that in Battleground in North Clark County. But in East County, we're going to go performance standard. And even in some of the rural lots, I believe we can go performance standard to meet the same requirement without having to apply that at a job. It should be up to the engineer whether they spec that out or they don't for that particular job. And the county has to enforce what was spec'd out in the stormwater design. Sorry for taking too much time.
That was great.
That was good.
Yeah, that's a good point, because there was some discussion at what point you have the projects comply with this requirement. And I don't know where we ended up with. Jim was trying to figure out what projects should be held to this standard. And I think, I don't know if we decided exactly what projects should be held to this standard. Do you remember the discussion of the session that we had, not the one that we had last week, the one prior? I think you did mention the date that after that the make development happened. So you were looking for some window and give people
a first.
So they won't have to be blindsided by this requirement. So I don't know. So it's similar to what Eric is saying. If it is not required, why are we asking people to do this?
It's not required at all, and then if it's required, gave them a date of April 1st, even though really it would roll back to January 8th, or technically it might roll back to the previous stormwater ordinance, and you really want to go there, but because some requirements were in there, but.
They weren't mandatory back then. They were an optional BMP. So what? And a lot of times, I can tell you, we spec'd them out on some of the rural lots because that was the best choice we had to. Especially if you're using this version, yeah, and you're not going through native, you're required to amend it. So some of the old projects we spec'd, some we didn't, and it depended on what was needed to meet the standard and meet the flow control targets. So some, and it's not like you can go out on a site and say you need to meet it. it actually takes looking through the stormwater design to see if it's required in this particular project or not. And I think a lot of the confusion is, it just said, any project after this day, any single family residence, we're going out there and we're enforcing sort of quality of death, which I don't believe it should be the case.
So are you saying, can you put additional capacity into your stormwater systems to avoid?
Yes, with the performance
standard. Was that partly what
you're saying? It's not always possible. Because they gave you the performance standard, but the threshold is so difficult to hit that in ways it's almost impossible to hit it without doing these things. So, they gave you this flexibility, but you still got to find a way to meet it, and it's not easy. So we're still going to be using soil quality in depth because we have to in a lot of areas when it applies under 4036. But the projects that don't, they have a stormwater plan. Well, we didn't even model that land as amended soil. We modeled it as compacted lawn. So the stormwater facility is already set up, and the plan's in place. We can't redo the subdivision to meet all these different pieces. And you don't necessarily apply these low-impact development techniques piecemeal either. It's a holistic approach. So as we look at new subdivisions, we're going to be doing this more often, and the builder's going to have to get used to it. But in the interim, we're not required to do it yet until it rolls out as it's supposed to in time.
Jeff, can you speak to, or anybody here speak to, what the increase in cost is going to be associated with doing this BMP with each lot? I could do a quick calculation of yardage of this specialty soil. I don't know how much this soil costs per yard. Is it a $30 per yard? Is it a $100 per yard mix? Is it a specialty mix that's not even available? And at 8 inches over the entire lot, if you're looking at a 5,000 square foot lot and you're, at 50% lot coverage, now you're 2,500 square feet at an 8-inch depth, and what's this? Does anybody have any idea what the additional cost is going to be?
I think that's part of the problem. You stated it. All those questions wrapped in the one, it's hard to wrap your arms around the cost, which is why, again, I'm promoting testing this to figure out what works. And right now, we're looking at probably, 4 to 6,000 a lot. It's quite a bit of money, but also there's unintended. I mean, you're taking your soils and tilling them up. Those soils are gonna, they're going to recompact, and then you're going to have sprinkler heads that are sticking up, and different, you're going to have warranty items.
Yes.
There's a host of things as you start thinking through it, and that we haven't even, I don't believe, scratched the surface on yet.
So if we look at just 50, if we look at a 5,000 square foot lot, 50% lot coverage, so let's say 2,500 square feet, that doesn't account for the driveway, at $50 a yard, this just the material cost is about $3,000. And you could probably figure on half again as much to doubling that for the labor associated.
And the availability of the material.
Is
one of the things that scares us.
Is it commercially available is a challenge right now.
Is it?
Especially for class, they have a certain type of compost. Is it like class A compost? You can get class B, which is probably has more pollutants in it than the ground you're taking out. But there's a certain type of compost you use that doesn't have, high
manure levels. Right. It has to be composted.
Yes. So, and finding sources for that right now is a challenge. Okay. The market will, they can get that much for it, I'm thinking about it.
So it's kind of like the bioretention.
There's your cost.
Yeah, it has
a
certain percentage of organic material in it. Mm-hmm.
pH balance is what
Yeah.
And does this material need to be tested then prior to it being placed on the...
Can you get an approved supplier that doesn't have to be tested anymore?
Approved supplier and certification of material.
Is it the same stuff as the bioretention material? But different?
Well, that is a lot of sand in it.
Okay.
Bioretention mix is a sand compost mix, basically. And the compost is basically the compost component in that bioretention mix.
Okay.
But there's a lot of different ways to hit it. There's chances that your native topsoil could meet the spec.
Okay.
And then there's chances where you could amend the native topsoil to meet the spec.
Mm-hmm.
Or you got to bring in all new stuff because you're not even close.
How is the county going to be inspecting this? Do we know?
Any thoughts, Dean?
I'm
not sure we need to do really much.
So do you take a soil sample, you take it to a lab that then...
Kim?
So, no, and this is Jeanette, this is our inspector, and she's dedicated. I hired her specifically to help with the stormwater stuff, although we have all of our inspectors, previous comment about, we'll have all the inspectors working with Jeanette, it's not the one person to cover the entire county, she'll kind of be the go-to person. A couple of other things, the compost material, Scoot's had me and I've been home this morning going over various options, it's about $21. So their estimates are more in the $1,500 range for doing this rather than what we've heard of the 64. And to tell you the truth, I don't know until people start doing it, figure out the economies of, and that's what many we've met with several builders, kind of trying to figure out, okay, what's our best option? You know, is a rain garden our best option in this particular area? And we have some amended soils. What's going to be part of your plan? And they're trying to do that without necessarily going to an engineered plan, because then you have the cost of an engineered plan. So you can always go do an engineered plan. And what we've been trying to do is work with the builders to come up with what's a solution that we think meets the requirements, and how can we help you help yourself get to the one that's most economical, most effective, and easiest to put in at various times of the year. So. Like Eric and others have pointed to, there's no one answer. And we're kind of in the same boat as all of you. I hope that you appreciate that we're coming on this, and it's being kind of hoisted the building to kind of like, we have to make sure the lots meet the requirements of the stormwater code. So we're trying to catch up. That's why I brought Jeanette on, and see if we can get out there, educate ourselves and others, and do the best we can at getting there. So try to be as reasonable and as effective. And if there's any part that anybody believes that we have misinterpreted and gone outside the realm, like Eric might point out, I'd be more than glad to give up any subdivision that we believe we ought not to go to, because this is not exactly our usual domain. We've been kind of putting erosion and stormwater over the years as the default persons of last resort at building sites. Our skills and expertise is really in construction. And so we're having to kind of learn with everybody else, so please, give us a little bit of grace. We're really not, we're not growing horns, and we're not trying to help as much as we can. And if there's any part of this that you find, hey, this subdivision doesn't even apply, and you guys assumed it did, and we can get there, that would be great. Well, we're trying to identify the ones that we need to work on, and we assume we've got the right ones, and if there's one out there, please let us know. But we've been working with folks, and not to use the example to beat that one, but this morning we had the landscaper, the excavator, and the general contractor all there kind of going over ideas. The excavator was coming up with ideas about how they could go rip through the backyards of several lots in their particular subdivision that they were looking at, get down to breaking up the ground down to the 12-inch depths, and then using the 2 inches of compost on top of it as both erosion and then rototilling it into the soils and meeting the requirements in that way. In certain times, it might be more beneficial to take out a full 8 inches and put 8 inches in. That's the most expensive. What we're trying to do is figure out any way of the builders that we can guide them to what's the best plan for your lot. And the best plan is probably not 8 inches of blown in soil amendments and replacing the topsoil. The best plan is one of maybe 6 or 7 options that work for that particular soil and that particular lot layout and the timing. And then we all agreed in that meeting that rolling this back to where as we get into it, how do the developments themselves include a lot more of this planning up front, and as we go down the road, hopefully as we develop subdivisions, a lot of this can be incorporated so it's less onerous on individual builders. So that's really the goal eventually getting there. And to answer your specific question, Jeanette will go out, she has a couple of tools, and we're going to check for the probe so she can check how deep we've gotten down. We're not sending anything off the labs or anything like that. We have the moisture meter and pH indicator as far as, and then we're going to look at load tickets and what was the process of putting it in. So our whole idea is to make sure that everybody's kind of, are you working in the direction we thought you were working in? We're not going to the corner and make sure that the cat, oh, he missed the corner. I hope everybody knows we're not going to that level of detail. Are you generally trying to meet the requirements? You have a stormwater plan that meets the requirements in the first place, and then inspect to that plan in the end.
Did you have something that...
My question was answered.
Okay. So to try to bring some closure, because we've got another presentation, but I'm looking for recommendations from the group, and it sounds like there's definitely some room for further discussion on this.
I'd be happy to lead a subcommittee, Don. I think that provided a pretty good avenue on our stormwater inspection fees about a year and a half ago when we responded to that. So it's obviously an urgent and needed concern that I think we ought to keep a very active, you know, process going on. So I'd be happy to lead a subcommittee group offline. We could we'll be coming back in to deep to report our progress on that. So.
Okay. And I know a lot of people came here because they're interested in this. So maybe when, as we're forming that, we can keep this group. We've got a sign-in list and contact info, correct? So we can keep everyone kind of abreast of what's going on. But one maybe, I like the idea of the subcommittee. I've got another little list that we've worked on. I don't know if
do you like it well enough to be on the committee?
I'll be there.
we could use you.
Before we go on, Mr. Jeffries had his hand up. So.
Well, I guess a question or clarification. What you're talking about sounds fine, but my understanding of the meeting last Friday, as of today, you're doing this regardless. What's happening in the meantime? What do we got houses out there under construction. For instance, your subdivision, we designed and built a subdivision based on stormwater guidelines that we need to meet the scandal of the water. Now we got the house done, we got advanced, and we're saying, well, we don't have occupancy, so we got to go back there and put in all this soil amendment. But the purpose of the soil amendment is to make these water, the stormwater taken care of, which we already did at the subdivision level based on the code that we required. So what's going to happen in the near future? And then the April date that came up, we got houses we finished since April, and we've got houses that are at the finished date that are supposed to be in there. What guideline do we go by at Nolte? Because those houses were sold. There isn't $8,000 or $10,000 in there to take this. It was built based to meet the stormwater requirement. So I guess I'm a little bit lost as to what's happening right now while we're waiting for the cyber. To me, the thing is figure out what works and then draw the line and say that was good. I understand how the county where you struggle with the stormwater plan, but in subdivision stuff that's already there, we know what the stormwater requirements were and we're taking care of all of them. So what's going to happen? And one other question is close to a little off subject, and that is all of these engineered stormwater plans that we're doing now all over the county. $2,500, $3,500. I talked to one private individual, paid $7,500 for stormwater engineering. Came in here and okay, that qualifies for the first platform. That's a lot of wasted money. I guess my question is, we've got soil maps for the whole county to tell us what type of soil we're dealing with. Why can't we use some kind of prescriptive path like we do for building? You can build it, get it in here, and build it that way, or you can use prescriptive maps. It's what we're dealing with, it works. So why can't we do that for stormwater? If this is this class of soil, we know the worst case scenario, if you do this infiltration, we'll take care of it. Spend the money on what you're doing and not spend it on engineering.
I'd like to have for a property on Friday, that SGA did stormwater plan. And it turned out to be, stormwater plan, infiltration test, engineering review, fee, $2,500 before we do anything. All the stormwater is entirely contained under 5 acres. It's not moving. And still unapproved. It's been 4 months. We're still working on it. Why not do a site inspection before all these things are implemented? Why not have a smart guy come out, an engineer, soils engineer, look at the site and say, okay, we've got all the stormwater contained on this particular lot. We don't have to go through all these hoops. It's not going. We at least do that.
I'm I'm open for.
Yeah, they have to speak to that. The requirements are the requirements. It's a code requirement. We don't have the flexibility. I totally agree with you 100%. That on a 5-acre lot, there is a very, very little chance of any stormwater impact on adjacent properties. I think most of us in the county have this. We believe that, you know, we agree with you on that. But the thing is, though, in order for us to approve the stormwater plan, we have to go through all these steps. And I don't know of any flexibility that then that the county code or the DOE provides for us. And like you said, you spend all the money, go through a lot of trouble, wait for 4 or 5 months. At the end of the day, you would have done something you would do 10 years ago. And I don't know what the solution is. I mean, it's the code, hard code.
Absolutely, that's
zero flexibility in what the requirements are. If you are doing it wrong or you are going over, I would appreciate the consultant to let us know that we are going over. But if you are meeting the code, that's what we are tasked to do. And it's our job to kind of cause that trouble for you. But, and it's not fun at all for us.
I understand your point. We need to find a way to somehow to kick this up a little bit and try to get the regulations changed. At least have a reason to look at it.
You're talking at the state level, right?
Yes.
You've got to go to the state level.
I think there's room on both.
It's not so much at the county level.
There's ways we can do it, I think, a little different. But it's minor changes. The biggest issue is at the state. That's outside of our control. And it's a whole other kind of lobbying effort. But I think there's some things we can do today, even, and it might take a little more work back to this work. One of the things that came up in conversation was, we're doing infiltration testing. Where we know the results are, we're professional. We've done this in so many areas. We know from the ASC study, if we're out near battleground, we're wasting our time on an infiltration test. We used to just say that, we used to do a statement saying, based on historical information, it's extremely unlikely to get infiltration in this area. So we went right to the next BMP, which would be dispersion. And as engineers, I think we have that ability to do that under performance standard. We don't have to go through the mandatory list. We don't have to go in the order and show that each one doesn't work. We can say that we're going to pick this one to meet it because this is, in our professional opinion, this is the best way to handle it. I'd like to have that leeway in the review to not require infiltration testing when we know that we're wasting $2,000. On their particular site, I think that was something that came up afterward in the review comment. They needed to get infiltration to show it wasn't possible before we went to splash blocks. So we're doing a very expensive test to prove that before we go back. Yes?
Mr. Chair? I think it's clear that we all should feel the pain, what you've experienced, and the county people too. The county people, they're on board with this. They don't think they like it any more than anybody else does. They're willing participants, that they want to come in. They don't want to measure every little lot corner. They want to help everybody get through the process. I like the approach. Subcommittee meets early, meets soon, meets fast, get the players on board, trying to come up with solutions that are achievable at the county level. The state is a whole different thing. But at the county level, what can we do as working collaboratively together to help folks get to the finish line as quickly and as with the least amount of cost as possible, but recognizing it's not cost-free anymore. It's changed. It is done, and it's going to cost money, period. But that's why housing goes up, 10% a year. That's one of the reasons why.
One other suggestion.
Yes.
The committee is great. I think we start that as soon as possible. The one item I'd like to address today is the 385 to 386 issue.
I'll follow up.
I think we need to stop enforcing that on projects that are vested.
I'll do some follow up and with other folks and make sure that we're not going to run afoul of legal risks. And I'll do that tomorrow.
And I think that near-term vesting was the only issue that I thought was...
I can't even find 385 on our code. It's been repealed.
I got a copy of it.
386. Before then, it was 380.
I got 380.
I just get it.
So we need a subcommittee.
Yeah.
Subcommittee, Eric?
I'll be on it. I've been against some other participants from our staff and are more on the fringes than I am.
Andrew?
Jeff?
I wonder if there's people in the
audience. Andrew, Jeff.
I'm really interested in this. I want to raise up their hand and throw out their number. Yes, of course, guys.
Jeanette.
Steve? Hold on
here. Well, I guess you're
yeah,
Leslie.
Yeah, but you? I don't know. I can't see or hear Steve or John. I don't know who Steve and John are.
Which one of those Jeffries brothers is raising their hands? Pat. Pat Jeffries. Do I hear Mark Jeffries? No, I don't. I see a head nod to your brother. I know how you work.
I think that's great, and thank you all for, I mean, you're welcome to stay for the rest of this, and thank you for your participation.
Don, just to make sure, could I, so we have Eric, Andrew, Jeff, from Deeb, I've got Jeanette, yes, and Pat Jeffries, is that right? Could you leave me a card? I want to make sure. Oh, okay.
I can get.
Okay, I need to get the email addresses. And Steve, is that right?
Yeah, Madison.
Steve Madison. Was there anyone?
John Girard.
John Girard.
And Jim.
Greg,
my name is too.
And Rod.
Jim Muir.
And Jim Muir.
Hey, I have a 3:30 conference call. I mentioned something. Impact fee resolution.
Okay, so you want to talk about that next?
Yeah, just right, real quick before.
Okay. So we're going to, before we move on to the next, sorry, thank you for your patience. Marty, did you want to?
So I have a 3:30 phone interview with TIB, so I have to leave in a minute. The Planning Commission work session tonight and then the hearing in 2 weeks is to address the impact fee deferral ordinance. If anybody's been tracking what the City of Vancouver is doing, we're going to model something very similar to that. Either you ask for a deferral on all fees or none. It's the way the systems work. We're looking at time final inspection. Again, it's very similar to what the City of Vancouver is doing, and it is an option for a builder to defer the payment of these impact fees. So that's just a quick FYI. Secondly, there's mention we have a board hearing on Tuesday. It's in the evening. It's the first Tuesday, so it's an evening hearing. 6:30? 6 o'clock. 6 o'clock Tuesday, we have two hearing items. One of note is a proposal to change building fees and land use review fees. We've not done that since about 2009, middle of 2009. So I've given groups information about that, and the board has had it since yesterday. So hopefully some of you will come and listen, testify in support of the proposal, and we'll move on.
I'm out of town, but Jamie's gone.
So I appreciate it, and I got to get to a phone call.
Thank you, Marty.
Thank you.
Yeah, Marty, I saw the date.
Whatever you're comfortable with, and then if you are going to be up here, we usually just move around a little bit so we can see you better. So it's totally up to you.
The table?
That'd be great.
Please.
That'd be great.
Hey, Carolyn, will you mind doing our PowerPoint presentation?
Okay, yeah. Yeah, and there's a clicker up there as well.
Is there a remote clicker?
Yeah.
There's a remote clicker. Oh, is there?
Yeah, up on the podium. The mic, can you wait? Do you guys want to say hi, please? I'm good here because I'll get a copy of that.
I think I have a copy.
Yeah, there was an extra.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
I'm represent the woman in the black and white? Okay.
I'm going off the little TV ad things, and I think it's her.
Actually, I watch it on TV. I tend to just block out the commercials, not even purposely. Is that okay?
I love this equipment here. Why don't we
go ahead and we'll reinitiate here. So when you're ready, when you guys are ready, please, Susan, thank you for
great
patience.
Not a problem at all. This is actually Jennifer's, so I'm surprised.
Downstairs?
No, Jennifer. Pardon me. Sorry, that's okay.
We've also got copies for everybody.
Perfect. So my name is Susan Wilson, and I'm with the programming team, Michael Derleth and Sherry Hare. Our main responsibility is to manage and adopt our six-year transportation improvement program. Also, we find grants and different partnerships and money to fund the capital transportation improvement projects. So today we're here to give you an update on the transportation improvement program. Plus, we'd like to inform you of a couple of discussions we've had with our county council. So I'm going to go ahead and hand it off to Michael.
Thank you, Susan. As Susan kind of mentioned in a little more detail, we'll be touching on several topics this afternoon, including the guiding principles and legal requirements surrounding the TIP and why we do some of the things we do with it. Including how projects get onto the TIP, a big picture look at project costs and typical sources of revenues that fund our projects, and we'll come back to share some challenges the TIP is currently facing, as well as some of the options that we've presented for potentially addressing those challenges, winding up with a review of current and future projects that are in the pipeline for us.
They have a presentation in front of them.
Okay.
I think
everybody's got a hard copy in their packet there.
Let's just motor ahead to the next page. The current guiding principles that we focus on when we develop the TIP, number one, always, is safety. That's the primary role of Public Works and a prime focus of the board. So that's number one when we start looking at potential projects and when they'll be programmed. We also focus quite a bit on preserving existing assets with robust programs for maintaining and updating roads, bridges, stormwater facilities. Of course, we have to pay debts for projects that we've already committed to. And then last but not least is building new projects off of the CRP. And those are controlled by several legal requirements. We have the legal requirements surrounding the GMA and the comprehensive plans. There are several laws in the RCWs and the WACs, there we are, that drive planning, including the requirement that all capital road projects that we do spend money on in a year are in the annual construction plan or ACP, and the TIP, the county engineer, is tasked to develop and apply some priority programming and some objective evaluation methods. And one of the other key requirements is that the county board needs to adopt the transportation plan and the TIP before we adopt the overall county budget. And if we're going to make changes to that, it needs to go through a formal board process. All of those designed to create some consistency and an organized path going forward. Getting into just a touch more detail, a little picture helps sometimes. Of course, we have the GMA that guides almost everything we do. That funnels into the county comprehensive plan and keeps us from choosing projects randomly. We have to provide consistency between the arterial atlas, any sub-area circulation plans, and the capital facilities 20-year plan. That leads us into the six-year transportation improvement plan. Which then is distilled down into the annual construction plan, which is the first year of the TIP, and shows what we're actively working on this year, including the specific projects such as the 119th Corridor, 10th Avenue, the 179th Interchange that we're actively spending on money this year. So again, hopefully it's consistent all the way up and down from very detailed documents to high-level planning structures guiding our decisions each year. And that legal requirement for consistency is also an RCW that we have to follow. So we mentioned before, the county engineer and the people who create the TIP and the ACP are tasked by law to have some sort of a ranking and evaluation system so that the best projects float to the top of the heap and we're spending the money to get the biggest bang possible. This is a bit of a representation on how we currently do that with our TIP. It's basically evaluated, projects in the TIP are basically evaluated on three objective main categories. A full one-third of the points are awarded for safety factors, including the accident history on a given road, any roadway deficiencies that the engineers identify. About 29% of the points are for economic development opportunities that creating the road would provide future industrial and commercial jobs. Are the roads through or in a focused public investment area? We also award about 24% of the points for mobility. Does this road we're looking at provide helpful links to other arterial and collector routes? Does it offer multimodal opportunities for pedestrians and bikes? Is there transit nearby whose access will be improved? And we look at concurrency as well to make sure that we're putting the roads where they need to be put. There's some points awarded for comparison to the County Arterial Atlas. Again, we're always looking at our planning documents to make sure that we're approaching things in an organized and consistent fashion. And then there's the other category, which is an important catch-all, but it includes evaluating the environmental impacts that a particular project is going to have. Do we have public and outside agency support? And leverage is becoming very important to our group. Can we leverage other grants? Can we leverage other funding sources? Are there development agreements, outside funding? You know, how can we stretch those dollars as far as possible? And it's all part of the ranking system that we use, again, to put a numeric score on the projects so that the higher scoring projects that deliver the most benefit to the county are the ones we're focusing on most earnestly. Another aspect of the TIP, in addition to the capital projects, is a number of substantial ongoing programs that are in each year's TIP. These fund smaller projects that don't always compete well against major arterial roadways. These ongoing programs also allow us to successfully compete for a variety of specialty grant programs, everything from safety to safe routes to school. The ongoing programs that you see there include specific funding for bridge repair and maintenance, road preservation including overlays and chip seals, rural road upgrades including culverts, construction of new sidewalks, new or upgraded ADA ramps. We've been doing a lot of work on signal upgrades and guardrail work in the transportation safety program. And there's also an urban development program that helps us identify road projects that stimulate economic development and industrial and commercial jobs in the county. So before we move to the financial side of the program, I guess I should stop to take a breath and ask, are there any questions on the ranking, the evaluation? Yes, sir.
This is not a challenge, it's just a question.
Right.
First of all, very good job. Thank you. But on your, on the maximum score ranking, for example, you have route connectivity, maximum score equals 5, weight 2, total points 10. Why the weight? Why not just maximum score 10? Maybe this is not even worth talking about, but I'm just
You know, it's a fair question, and I'm relatively new to the ranking portion of the DIP, so I think I'm going to ask Susan to help with that.
What it does is it helps with the weighting, and it helps even things out. So let me try to explain this, because I haven't ranked the projects for a while now, so I'm kind of going off memory here. But instead of changing the whole evaluation, we can weight it against each project. So it's based upon a percentile and fairness of the program. Does that make sense?
No, but I'm
good. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. It's just another math question.
Okay.
Forgive me. 33%, 29%, 24% equals, if my math is right, 86%.
And okay. 14 for other.
14 for other.
Yep. Stay on at the bottom.
I'm hiding at the bottom.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Got it. Yeah.
We were testing you.
Yeah. Math made perfect sense, but this is another question. So where does it come in when you get a match? Is that, you mentioned the match. How does that weigh into this? If you were getting federal highway dollars, for example, how does that play into the score?
So if we get a match on our grants, it gives additional points. So if you look at our evaluation system in our program, it actually gives, like if you have 80%, it gives an additional 2 points, I believe. If you have 60%, it gives additional, 1 point. I'm not sure I'd have to look exactly with the weighting, but it gives additional points for secured funding. We get a federal grant, we get a state grant. We don't want to keep evaluating these projects over and over again. So the more points it has, the more money we spend on these projects, it actually goes into an obligated field to where they don't get evaluated any longer because we're really committed to building them. So
if we can provide match, it helps us with the individual grant applications, and when we have grants or other outside funding that we can leverage, that helps the other score.
Yeah. Well, if you look at all the projects and you look at the priority array, all the projects are good projects. They're really within decimal of being funded. And so sometimes we'll skip projects because there might be a funding opportunity. It might be something that fits well within a safety grant or what have you. So what we do is we'll skip around a little bit in our program. Oftentimes what we find is we have large projects, and for large projects we need larger pots of money. And we'll have to get multiple funding sources to fund some of these larger projects. But we don't wanna, but if you get, a certain percentage of grant funds, we're really committed to building it. So we need to proceed with the project, and it should receive additional points and extra additional points in the evaluation system. So it kind of moves up in its priority.
Well, the grant agencies are looking for partnerships, the public-private partnerships, that kind of thing. So that's important to them to know that we're kind of all attacking the same challenges in the infrastructure. So I think that's where some of that's showing up in their grant applications, to what other partners or funding do you have to bring to the table, and they're looking specifically for those kinds of partnerships between state, federal, and private. So.
Well, and if we do, we actually get additional points for private partnerships.
Right.
And some of these funding sources are within points of being funded. So if you have an additional point for, say, traffic impact fees, for example, that can get you, that can be the threshold of $2 million or nothing. So, of course, we should look at that.
So, moving on, I believe Sherry here takes over to explain the finance side of the program. Sherry?
Thank you, Michael. So, definitely people ask the question, where's the money go? That's everybody's favorite question. In a particular project, we find about 81% lands in construction. Before we ever get there, though, we do have 8% that goes to design and permitting, and approximately 11% that goes to land acquisition, and of course that's variable depending on the project. And then, where does the money come from? Well, it comes from several sources. County Road Fund does make up a large portion. We do have traffic impact fees, and you'll see that's about 7%. Federal grants, you'll see 22% or so. State grants, 10%. And we are extremely aggressive in our grant applications. Public Works Trust Fund loan is sitting at 6%. That many in the near future will be headed towards 10th Avenue projects. County Arterial Preservation Program is about 2%, and partnerships make up that last 1%. And then I'm going to go ahead and pass that off to Susan. She'll tell you about some of our challenges.
Let me give you just a quick question.
Sure.
So on the traffic impact fees, the 7%, is that since the fee holiday? Or
yeah, that is question. with, you know, that this, I looked at 3 years of data and pulled it together. So yes, those 3 years do have the fee holiday.
Okay, thank you.
It's actually a little closer to 6 if you're pulling it in.
So if you're looking at this, this is really 3 years of data.
Okay.
And what we have is we have the urban holding traffic impact fee on 119 that has a private public share match. It has actually a high public share. So we had to save a lot of that money to spend it on 119. So that number's being a little skewed. So if you look at the past maybe 10 years, it might be a little lower. It could be a little higher because TIFs are market driven.
Okay.
Very interesting.
So, but that's being a little, it's being skewed just a tad bit, so keep that in mind because of that urban holding on 119th.
Do you expect that then number will go, so it sounds like you expect that number to go down, but could it even go down more dramatically because of the fee holiday and the effects that we start to feel over the long-term time frame, or do you think that you're not going to see it reflected?
So, Susan, is this based on spending or receipt?
This is based upon receiving, right?
Okay.
It is.
Okay.
What's that percentage been in the past,
generally?
It's really market driven. I'm thinking of the past 10 years. You know, I have a chart. Let me show you the chart that I have. Because in the past 10 years, we received 1.2 to 4.3. Because it's like this when we...
This one?
Keep going, 14.
No, it's this one. No,
it's
that one.
Page 11.
Yeah, so if you look at the past 10 years, we've received 1.2 to 4.3 million. It's market driven. We don't. It's really hard to forecast.
Oh, okay. I see.
Okay.
But look at the fee.
Okay, very good. Thank you. That
yeah.
Answers
yeah, we'll get there. Yeah.
So
the fee waiver numbers from about a month ago.
Okay. Right?
Correct.
Those numbers are different today and much higher, I believe.
Yeah, we haven't updated that.
So what would the percentage be if this fee was part of the traffic impact fee amount at 5.7?
I'd have to run it.
It'd be
higher.
Yeah.
What's the total number here in the revenue side? That'll answer your question.
For the total.
You add all these up, 100% of this.
It's about 25 to 30 million a year is what
30.
We have.
Okay.
For the construction program.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay. So what we did in July and August is we went to our county council. And we came to them with a couple challenges that we face. There's really two main challenges. The first one is that we need immediate funding for 2017 and 18 to fund Northeast 10th Avenue and 119th Street. Keep in mind, we did submit a couple grants for 119th Street. So if we receive $3 million, if we receive $6 million, we may not need that immediate funding. We're not going to know until after Thanksgiving when they make the announcement. So we're still waiting to hear from that. Typically, in the past, we've had our funding secured, maybe a year or 2 years in advance. Now we're going by the seat of our pants, and it's taken us longer. 10th Avenue, we've been trying to get this project funded. I mean, for five years, we were really relying on a Public Works Trust Fund loan, but that was swept, as you know. We've applied for state money, we've applied for federal money, and it's just not happening with that project. Same thing with 119th. We did receive some federal funding. Hopefully it's in the queue right now of $3 million for that project. So that's one of our needs that we face today, one of our challenges that we face today. Another thing is, the revenue is just not keeping up with this, with the expenditure. It's not sustainable. And I'll go into a bunch of charts to explain why that is from past to future.
So the 10th Avenue is north of 179th Street?
It's bridging Whipple Creek.
Bridging Whipple Creek.
South.
South, okay.
Yeah.
And the 119th would be towards the west, westbound.
It's from 50th to 72nd. And then under construction right now, that's substantially complete, is from 72nd to 87th. And then the easterly end is another portion we have to complete, and that's from 87th to 112th by the written code.
Thanks.
Okay. So major changes from the 2016 adopted TIP to now is Northeast 10th Avenue. I talked a little bit about that. We do have a $3 or $4 million funding gap. So we'll see what happens there. We also have had some urgent projects come up. The Salmon Creek Slide, that's east of 50th Avenue. That's a safety issue. We have to address that. That's about a $900,000 fix. We are applying for some FEMA money, some emergency money. I'm still negotiating that. I'm not sure what's going to happen there. The bridge manager came to me and said Davis Bridge. There was some flooding last December, and as a result, there's some major scour issues. We may have to replace that bridge. That's off of Ward Road, 197th and Davis. So we don't know if that's going to qualify for some federal dollars. We're still seeing what we can do about that, but we may have to replace that, and that's going to be about a $1 to $1.3 million. And then the 7-year gap with funding for 179th Street area improvements. We do have a $50 million Connecting Washington state funding for that, but that's out until 2023-2025. We're working with our county council members and the legislators to hopefully advance that money. Also, as part of the Connecting Washington money, we have to do a practical design concept on that. So I'm working with the Washington State Department of Transportation to get those efforts started now, so by the time the money becomes available, we can go into design of 179th Street and all the area improvements that need to be done. So one thing that we showed the county council is just a little background of past versus now. So 10 years ago, this is what happened. Our preservation was $4.5 million. Now our preservation costs are $7.8 million. And it's still not enough money to meet all the needs that need to happen. Plus, there's a mandate where anytime we overlay a road, we have to bring the guardrail up to standard. You know, because the asphalt gets higher, that means the guardrail needs to move higher with it to meet the standard. And then the ADA needs to also be addressed. That is a mandate. That's costing us multi-millions of dollars each year to do all those fixes. So that's less asphalt on our roads. Debt service, that's mostly from the Salmon Creek Interchange project. We were paying $1.1 million, $1.2 million, now it's $2 million. Not a lot of money, but it still adds up. Clark County Sheriff's Diversion, $1.2 million in 2007. And prior, now it's $4.5 million. Clean water fees, almost $2 million. That's increased about $1 million. So on the revenue side, the property tax of the 1%, we haven't received that for a while now. That brought about $300,000, $400,000 to the program. But the thing with that is it's accumulative. So there's an overall loss of about $4 million in the past 10 years. And then in the past, we received large transportation packages, authorizations for like the Salmon Creek Interchange Project, Patton Parkway. And it was $10 million, you know, $20 million. We're not seeing those reauthorizations, those big federal funding packages any longer. Yeah, we got Connecting Washington money, so out of the $50 million, we have $15 to $20 million to fix the local road system there. But those are really dwindled in the past 10 years. Traffic impact fees, we talked a little bit about that. 1.2 to 4.3 million, that's really market driven. The forecast is like this. So what we're doing is we're forecasting it, we're programming it in our six-year program, but we're also doing a quarterly reconciliation on it because we can't, it's hard to rely on something that's market-driven. So sum that up, what was available for our transportation improvement program was $13 to $17 million worth of county road fund 10 years ago. Now we have $10 to $11 million worth of county road fund that goes into this program. $7 million is going to preservation. So the $800,000 is the that's actually fuel tax that is for preservation. So if you, you know, $11 million minus the $7 million, we're not receiving a lot of money for our program any longer. So it's really hard to leverage dollars for our grants, for traffic impact fees, everything that we do. You guys have any questions about that?
On the transportation project funding sources, what role is there in the competition? I know East County has been a recipient of some recent in the last five, you know, say four, 3 to 5 years. Are you competing against other cities in the county? I mean, and how does that play? Is there just less money available overall, or is the county getting less money because others are recipients?
Well, there's always competition for the dollars, but it seems like it's just staying steady. It's not increasing. Like with our federal STP dollars, for example, it's staying steady at $4.2 million. And that's for the region. And so that's for all the small cities. It's competition for our region. And Transportation Improvement Board state dollars, we get a little more there, but that's a higher competition. But at the average dollar we receive that we can leverage state against federal is probably about $4 million. So for these large projects such as 10th Avenue or 179th, you know, a $23 million project, when you're getting $4 million here and $4 million there, that's $8 million. That's still a big gap there.
How
so
can
big
we
projects.
Our ability to compete for those dollars.
It's really the large funding packages. So, like for Salmon Creek Interchange, the reauthorization. So it's lobbying efforts.
And we don't have them. That's maybe.
We're getting them from our county council. I think our county council are supporting lobbying efforts, like 479th, the Connecting Washington money. They're lobbying to move those forward. So
I can give you some opinions after. Okay.
Susan, maybe misinterpreting this chart right here, but the current and future cost on an annual basis, far right side, 782, 4.5, 2.8, 17.1 million. Do the math below on the revenue side, on the low numbers, 15, 1, 5, and 10, you get 26.5 million. Mm-hmm. Just the math says we're 9 million ahead, but I'm missing something.
Yeah, it's not going to add up because
we're spending down our
road fund.
Our fund balance.
And so here's what I would say, because I'm on the same team, right?
Sure.
Maybe add something in here that shows the bad, you know, the current, real current state of affairs, because the quick math is, everything's fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It does. Yeah. And right now we have a lot of reserve. And the reason why is we had two or three projects that were delayed. And so, as Sherry was saying earlier, the bulk of our money that we spend is on construction. So if you delay two large construction projects, I mean, you're going to delay multi-millions of dollars here. So we're kind of living, we're spending down our reserve to move forward. And so that reserve is going to be gone. And what's going to happen that I see in the program is we're going to be kind of stuck a little bit, save up all of our money, and then build projects. But in the meantime, we miss funding opportunities.
And speaking of that, has there been a missed window because the traffic impact fee has been waived? Do you see that as potentially significant enough that you might have missed an opportunity?
We haven't run the analysis on that. But 10th Avenue has been hard to fund.
It says 5.7 on here on the fee waiver, but we're starting to see some draft numbers that are much higher than that. So it's catching up with us. And as we move forward. Right now, we're just, my understanding is they're just waived on the commercial only. We're still getting fees in on the residential, but the stuff that is getting waived is really adding up to be, and it's hitting the program, because that is part of why we can't move forward. And we may have to take little breaks between the really big projects to get the balances and the funding partners to deal with us.
Well, and even bringing up the next tier of projects.
Right, that's true.
Because it takes about 3 to 5 years to design and permit. And so what we really want to have is we always want to have projects in the hopper. We always want to be designing something. That way, one project fails, we move another project up.
So this is, again, a friendly comment. Mm-hmm. Forgive me for beating this to death.
Sure.
If you show the county councilors this slide, and they do the math, case met, request denied, you got plenty of money. You know what I'm saying? Something needs to change on here.
Yeah,
so
we did show them that. We did show them that. And they were actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're
we showed them. Yeah, these are actually the same slide we showed them.
Way ahead of it. Okay.
But
the fee waiver loss and what you're projecting for the fee waiver loss in the future, and there are other areas that you can make it up, but it does bridge the gap, or comes very close to bridging the gap. Coincidentally, I mean, you can make it up in other areas, but I mean,
you program more money in other projects that offsets road fund that. I mean,
no doubt
those are policy decisions. And they have a number of options at the board's disposal, so, he's right.
No, I mean,
which pot
it's in the numbers.
Yeah.
Sorry. 10th Avenue, you know, I keep hearing that, but it sounds like a very high priority project, but that's from, what, 149th to 179th, is that?
There's two phases of that. The one that has the major funding gap that we want to take out to construction early 2017 only goes from 154th to 164th.
Okay. Because part two of that question was 179th is, well, it's either completely broken or it's locked up, depending on your perspective, maybe. So we're trying to free up this corridor to the broken intersection. And so I'm wondering if, I'm not quite clear why 10th is such a high priority.
I bet you Jamie
can
answer.
I can tell you.
Oh,
the diversity of
this. You kind of have to remember, I think 10th Avenue started quite some time ago as an option to create some economic development activity on the west side of I-5. And that was done really at a time still in economic crisis here in the county, and so I think there was a lot of resources moving that direction to try to kickstart some jobs up there, especially recognizing that 179th had development agreements not only with Washington State and Cooper, but with Kelly Pacific on a lot of stuff that basically halted that. After that had happened, the economy started picking up, and the state looked like they were going to package. Those efforts were laserly focused on that and some other interchanges around the county. And we were successful in securing quite a significant amount of money for that improvement. The problem is it's been kicked out so far in timing that we're hopeful, I think, and we're getting good signals from those in position to know that we might be able to move that up. And again, I think that one's going to be one of it's really a private-public partnership with the state coming in with a big chunk of dollars to resolve that. So I kind of see the 179th corridor as being separate in the state from 10th and some other issues that are out there. I think once 10th is constructed along with 179th, and then we have 15th on the east side, and then 134th, we're going to have a really, really nice circulation pattern there. By a lot of that 29% economic development opportunity goals.
Any other questions on?
Great presentation. Thank you.
So we went to the council and we presented some options for them. So we, delay or shelve projects. So basically this is no changes to the funding situation we're in. and significantly reduce the ongoing programs. That, you know, I've done that. I've delayed a couple sidewalks, safety issues. We have to address all the safety issues. Preservation, that takes a lot of road fund, but one of our guiding principles is to preserve what we have. We can increase revenue, reinstate the 1% property tax, the sheriff's diversion, reduce that, eliminate the TIF waiver. I know there's been talk about that, bonding. And then also another opportunity is the transportation benefit district. The city of Vancouver, as you might know, they implemented a car tax fee. And so the council, that's another option for the council to look at. And then a combination of approaches. So.
I wasn't at that meeting. What, in regards to bonding, did you receive any response back in regards to bonding? It seems like there's some opportunity there, especially since, you know, you lost what was available to you through the state. So is that something that it seems like there's opportunities there that we're not taking advantage of?
You know, we didn't go into a lot of the options because these are big changes, and it takes time for those changes. So I didn't get any answers,
okay,
if that's what you're wanting to know. We did talk about a line of credit. So we take these large projects out to construction. We get a line of credit, and then we basically pay it back within a year. So we talked about that. I'm not sure what's going to happen with that. I'll have to meet with a couple of the financial experts to explore those opportunities.
So the commitment back to the board was stay the course, talk about the line of credit to keep things moving forward, and then have this finance group work with Susan on some of the other options. And so I think they're gonna try and develop some of that with the finance group, and then that will come back to the board, I think. Is that's
true.
That's a longer term.
But then also I'd like to reassess all of our revenues and our expenditures. I want to see where we're at with 10th Avenue, you know, the new engineer's estimate. I want to see if we got the additional state funding. See if we got additional TIF dollars. I'm not sure, but we'll reassess the whole program, figure out where we're at before we award 10th Avenue and 119th. So I think this one is over to you, Sherry, is that right?
It is, thank you, okay. Susan. So as you can see, even with the constraints we have, we are delivering projects over on, you'll see at the top, 2016 to 2022 and later. The gray area is going to be current deliverables. So you're looking at Northeast 99th Avenue, Northeast 119th, that would be the section 72nd through 87th that I believe somebody back here is driving through regularly and not thrilled about. But we love it, and it's an awesome project. Orchard's TSO, that's going to be traffic signal management. Cedar Creek Bridge, Brush Prairie Bridge. And you'll see under each of these, it'll tell you some of the funding sources. So I apologize for backing up a bit, but STP funds, Transportation Improvement Board funds, you'll see CMAC funds on there. So those are things that were awarded grants. Northwest Cardi Road Culvert, you'll see that came in with some CRAB money and some STP money as well. 58th Street Sidewalk, 65th through Andreessen, Hayes and Lockwood, and Washougal River. Those are going to be guardrail safety projects that we did get a HSIP grant for. That next area that's going to be a yellow highlight there for you. These are the projects that we are planning to move forward with our optimistic schedule that the board has asked us to continue to consider.
I appreciate the clever use of right.
That would be our traffic engineering section. Rod Klug's sense of humor right there, yes.
There's actually a Steve,
very
too.
And funny.
There is a Steve, there's a Wright, there's a, yes.
I should share some other names with you, Jamie.
Yeah, we've had to shoot a few down.
Yeah, I had to tell him no a couple of times. I'm not having that in my program.
the Steve timing.
The signal timing?
Yeah. Are we talking about people going around programming all the messed up, what I would consider messed up timing, you know, and signals, which I know everyone would, whichever direction they go, they all consider them messed up. But I mean, do we pay for people to go around them? This would be like,
that's how you get corridor management to work is to have your signals timed up. And working with, we have to work with WSDOT, we have to work with the City of Vancouver, we have to have our signals working and running. And frankly, we have one of the best signal engineers around.
It's better communication throughout the corridor. And some of this stuff is adaptive communication. And so it adapts to the traffic flow.
It's actually very telling people that are employees that we're timing those signals, but yeah. Professional, or we're outside people to time signals.
A lot of it now is automatic. It's based on the traffic flow that the computers and the signals and the loops in the road recognize right now. And when it's not automatic, a lot of the signal timing can now be done from a room here in the county, so we're not having to disperse technicians in trucks and take all that time to run out to 15 different places. It can be done with a few keystrokes.
And that's been very successful because it's mostly grant funded. It's a 13% match. So it's very little road fund.
Of all the things we do, it seems that is the lowest hanging fruit on the tree.
Yep. Exactly.
Just manage what you got.
Yep.
So
exactly.
You know, anyway, just want to affirm that.
Absolutely.
You have pretty... I'm going to just crash for a second, even though traffic signals are irritating to everybody.
We should name one after Jamie, I think.
We should. I think we can get there.
It is a way to get the most efficient use of the system that we've got. And so I'm actually kind of proud of the region here, all working together. There's a lot of committees that are doing that. Interagency cooperation, connecting networks together, talking to each other. They've done a really good job. Our group is very forward for the nation even. And they actually go out and teach others how to do what they do. So it's pretty amazing.
It's awesome.
Nationally recognized.
They're a very good group, and they do, you know, as you can see, we're delivering a lot of those types of projects. And in 17, 18, you know, when we're talking about 10th Avenue being a large project we're going to deliver, you know, that's $23 million. These signal projects are, you know, $1 million a pop. And we are getting them funded because we as a county, are forward-thinking. So we do have a really good team. 119th, we're going to continue along that corridor. You'll see that spread out over the course of this sheet here on the second line. But 17, 18, we're looking at 50th to 72nd Avenue. We have applied for funds on that. We were awarded some funds there, so that's good. Did you? Okay. Highway 99. Yes, RTC money, yes. Highway 99 sidewalk is another one, right, which you talked about, Steve. Salmon Creek slide repair, that's one that came up that we just, you know, we have to address safety issues. So when we have a slide, when we have a culvert issue, when we have any of those things, safety is one of our top priorities, and we do address those. So that was kind of a surprise, and it's being taken care of as well. Susan's working with FEMA for funding for that. And then you'll see 99th Street, SR 503. Moving out further, we have a little bit of space in the program there. We're hoping that grant funding comes along or that we are able to fix some funding issues so we can move forward a little faster. But that white section is going to be your the tier, what we would call tier two programs. That's going to be 10th Avenue, the 149th to 154th, 119th Street East, 179th Street, which we will probably break up in phases. There is some good connecting, connecting Washington money on that, and there's some partnerships there. We will have Blair Road is another one, and Northeast Highway 99. We also have Manley Road. And then we do have several things in the hopper. If we're able to get grants for them, Flatwood, Knapp Station, Lethal, Little Washougal River, Bentley, those are all going to be ones that we can build them if the grants are awarded there. Munch Road also is a build if a grant is awarded. And then out much further in the green area, you're going to see 15th Avenue. 99th Street, that's going to be 94th Avenue to SR 503, Salmon Creek Avenue realignment, 72nd Avenue, and those are, you know, some large projects out there. At the bottom, you'll see all the way across ongoing programs. We've got road preservation, sidewalk ADA, culverts and slides. You would have heard Michael talk about these ongoing programs before. Bridge repair and transportation safety. And that whole program for that length of time, you're looking at about those two lines, about $94 million right there.
Wow.
Mm. All right, so then, any questions on that?
Good chart.
Thank you. I believe I had help with that one. Thank you, Michael.
So that's so that chart that you just saw is an optimistic schedule.
It is very optimistic.
So if we fail to get grant funds, line of credit, we'll have to shift the projects.
So then if you'll turn the page there, our next steps, we've already, you know, had the work sessions with the board and the follow-up work session, and they said please proceed with the optimistic vision there, and I think Carolyn and Susan both addressed that. So our next thing is we're going to get the TIP ready to go for the future year, get that adopted, and move forward. So our hearings, we have a notice for public hearing going out around the 27th, and we will have public hearings on the 18th. We actually have to amend the 2016 TIP to include the Salmon Creek Slide area that was unforeseen. We do have the annual construction program for 2017 and then our six-year TIP program that we will be looking to adopt. I think that's all I have. So let's...
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, do we have any additional questions or...
Thank you
for having us. Yeah.
Thank you
for
having us.
Thank you.
Okay. Do you want me to go back to the weighted question?
You know,
I haven't ranked the projects for a while, so I had to refresh myself.
Thank you.
A little bit. Yeah, so.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, so what you have is you have certain categories, like you have additional travel lanes, center turn lanes, sidewalks, bike lanes. So say you have that category. You have a max of 5 points of a weight of 2. So since you have the max of 5 points and the weight of 2, it puts priority on safety components in the project.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah. That makes sense?
It does.
So a project can get, you know, a max of 5, but it can get really 12, but it has a max of 5, but it weighs 2, so it can get 10.
I understand.
Make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. I just haven't read these for a while, so. Yeah. Okay.
Thanks again. Appreciate all
your time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Next up, Jamie. Yeah. Or sound. Yeah. So, where do I begin? So, I sent an email out this afternoon. As part of the 2016 GMA update, the board created two new zoning categories. One was A10, the other being FR20. Apparently, Eric and I were just made aware of this on Friday, but there were some associated code amendments that were adopted concurrently with that. And I don't recall the DEEB ever having looked at those code implementing those specific zoning districts. And trying to go through a lot segregation on an FR20 zone, kind of run headlong into what I view as a code conflict. And I'm not sure where the code provision came from, so I thought I would bring it to your guys' attention for discussion and figuring out what we want to do, if we want to.
It looks like an error to me from what you said. Is that the county's position on this?
I don't know what the county position is.
So I know that through, I guess I'd say second, I know a lot of people that do segregations, and the county prosecutor's office has always questioned the segregations and considered them, I guess for lack of a better word, another loophole. I hate to use that word, but it's a word that's driving me crazy right now. And that I don't know that it came from the county, but I know that Chris Horn has been looking strongly at segregations, doesn't like them, they come across his desk, you know. And I'm not surprised that this 2016 change came something that take away segregation.
So what I thought I would do.
Jamie, real quick, yeah. What specific section in here are you saying that you can't, I'm assuming that you're saying that you can't do an exempt provision of Forest 20?
Yeah. So, I think you can, because I think there's a code conflict, but
So where is the conflict?
So if you look under this big tall one,
yeah,
and it's 4210.
Let me go past the uses. Are you assigned a good insertion?
But Jamie's not alone in his interpretation. I've got three separate emails. You guys probably have two.
It seems like there's no logic to applying a plat for 20-acre lot and a forest on our ag zone. What difference
okay.
does that make?
Okay, it's right here. It's on page 9 of 32. And there's an E subsection, and then if you go down to
ED,
okay. or E1D, it says, in the FR20 zoning district, land divisions that result in parcels less than 40 acres in size must be platted and meet the additional requirements of this chapter. So then you turn to, County Code 45-40-020,
yeah.
and you look under
B4B, yeah.
divisions of 20 acres
right.
and odd are exempt from platting.
So back to D though, would this be a non-conforming lot condition? I mean, that seems to be what they're getting to, because if you have two 20s, you don't need to do platting, so I'm reading that.
I don't know what they're trying to achieve.
Marty, you get into it. Doesn't
so I think
across your desk, and haven't said it's been a headache?
So
from the county standpoint, Chris?
I talked to Gordy Euler yesterday,
yeah.
and I asked the question because this came up late last week. And I think the intention was that it just means zoning, that you have 20 acres in an ag 20 zone, right? That you don't, you could seg it, but you just want to make sure that it means zoning, not platting.
But it says in the FR20 zoning district, land divisions that result in parcels less than 40 acres
yeah.
must be platted.
And maybe it should be less than 20 acres.
20 acres.
Yeah.
That's all it takes.
Yeah.
So that.
Because the idea is that as long as you meet zoning
yeah.
and you still can seg, that's all we would want
that's all
to
you
provide.
So I'm just bringing it to my somebody's attention that I think is an error.
Yeah.
And if I produced this nice sheet that I kind of use as the lawyer's cheat sheet.
Yep.
Some of my notes are on it.
Looks like it came from Rich tonight.
It talks about the history of you know common ordinances affecting building lot size, and it goes through the history of you know when subdivisions were added, and you couldn't the short plat ordinance, you know, and you couldn't do it for RCW. The exemptions changed, so you had to have a minimum of 5 acres under RCW 58. When GMA came into effect. The county then moved that in 1993 to be 20 acres in size, and they haven't touched that for lots of policy, so you can still do exempt divisions of land that were 20 acres or more, and I don't think any policy reason should suggest that we should deviate from that in the code here, so I would hope that we correct that.
So do you remember the code language that was then in front of the Planning Commission and board? I mean, we do the edit version, so there's
yeah.
strike-throughs and underlines.
Yeah.
I wonder if something was just an oversight.
Yeah, I'll have to go back and look at that.
Because it talks about Ag 10, and if you have 20 acre or more, you can just go through at the exemption.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a twist to this. I think part of that is a lot of people don't remember those exemptions because it rarely comes up with county staff. We've been in situations where we've had to give chain of title on lots that it's like, no, you don't need that. It's more than the parcel size. And okay, well, we'll concede with the chain of title on a 160 acre lot or a parcel that we're not dividing. But it's there's an opposite issue here as well. That we don't really need a legal lot.
But that chain of title might just only be for a legal lot determination.
Well, if you're over the minimum, then, you know, yeah. you're over. It's just anyway. I don't want to get too far.
Why do you feel
that? Yeah, it's just know, we conceded. We said, okay, we'll go to the title company. You know, it's sometimes easier to just say yes.
Yeah, I think in this case, you know, again, from my perspective, if it's exempt by state law, it's exempt under this section of code, and it has been for more than 20 years, which is one of 30 years, we should have that consistency there. So as long as you meet the zoning, you should be able to.
I mean, it's so low density. I mean, it's not like you're really, it's not a material difference other than the big process.
So I thought I would bring this to the board's attention.
Yeah, it looks like we're in.
Agreed. What's the, do we make the recommendation to the board then, or?
Well, I think it's, isn't it, staff's aware of it.
I was just made aware of it.
They're now aware of it.
Let me qualify that. I was made aware of this Friday.
Right, yeah.
So last week.
I guess I'm gonna take it to the Board of County Councilors next week in a meeting. I guess I wanted to check with this board and make sure that it seemed consistent with everybody else's.
It does. And we don't want to wait around for another biannual code review to get it changed if that is that kind of where we're going with this. Jane?
Yeah.
Are you looking to not have this wait until there's I could see somebody saying, well, no, you can't do that because it is that zone, and the code says this. Even though it's an error, you still can't do it because it's still in code.
Well, I mean,
we don't have that neat little thing in code that says the responsible official may make a decision like the city of Vancouver has.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right, that is stupid. I'll let you go ahead and do that. That is clearly
common sense overrules.
Yeah.
I think my
I don't like code conflicts, so I'll tell you that.
I know.
Yeah, I think on this one it may require, fortunately, sort of some emergency action to correct the.
Okay, so that's why you changed it. Thank you.
I think we're done for public comments. Steve?
Tom?
Yeah, we've been tracking for a little while the ratio of SFR permits to new lot creation county. First 6 months anyway, we're about 7 million. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but it looks like from the county website we're at about 750-ish single family residential permits issued in the first half of the year. We're just slightly over 400 new lots created. So clearly, if you extrapolate forward, we're mining our lot inventory fairly rapidly. I just wanted to ask, I heard what I think I heard in terms of the stormwater conversation we had, that if we have an approved stormwater plan, that we are vested in that plan going forward.
That's what the Homer County and the college said.
Right. And the question then arises, what if you have an approved stormwater plan for the first phase of your development? You have a four-phase or three-phase development. Subsequent phase is going to have to be engineered, or does the vesting occur at the subdivision application?
It does not, to my knowledge.
That's a dicier question.
Right. Okay. So that's our primary concern right now in that issue. So we believe we can proceed forward with our approved phases. You know, we have two large developments. We only have one approved stormwater plan for one phase, and we've got two stormwater plans currently pending approval for two phases of the other development. So it's really going to create, you know, where we've already moved dirt. Done a substantial amount of grade work on the Rivendell project. It's really going to throw a huge wrench into our program, and having to re-engineer or change our engineering procedures right in the middle of a phase development. So that's one issue. And I guess I'll just raise it because it's it's not on anybody's agenda or work plan, but it's something we're running into. And again, this is why I preface my comments with the lot generation ratio is that it may be that more developers are going to want to take advantage. We bonded the Rivendell project, but unfortunately our bonding code only allows for model homes to be built, which is, it's kind of a bygone era, I think. The old style model home with the flags waving on it and stuff. We have no intention of building those on any of these developments, most, at least in our Rivendell development. I think we have 30 lots pre-sold right now. So I guess I would encourage another look at that as to how we can utilize it, because it's certainly not a requirement in other jurisdictions. It's almost unique to Clark County in terms of this model home requirement.
Steve, just clarification.
Yeah.
What are you asking for? I heard you talked about model homes, but we're not going to do model homes anymore.
Right, because
what do you want?
The bonding, what we would like would just to be able to bond and build.
Build the whole subdivision?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just like we do in other jurisdictions.
Got it.
There that is not uncommon in other jurisdictions in the state of Washington.
Got it.
So I haven't looked at the model home ordinance in a long time.
Yeah.
And my understanding and my thought is that you would build a model home on a phased project where you don't have all your improvements in.
Exactly. That's right.
So you're going to get three or four model homes.
Yeah.
But when you build the subdivision
and
you've got your improvements in, take out a permit like you would for lien and make that your model home. That's my very high-level construct.
The issue, though, Marty, comes in is what level of infrastructure are you requiring? In other words, we can build houses without paved streets. In fact, it's almost better to do that. So in other words, there at what level of infrastructure improvements? Like now, for example, Rivendell development. By this goes to the commissioners on the third tier councilors on the 13th, assuming they approve. We'll record on the 14th. At that point, we're ready to begin pulling permits. We will have sewer, stormwater, we will not have paved roads, but we will have curbs, we will have virtually most of the other infrastructure, certainly everything we would need to begin residential construction. And yet the code doesn't allow us, it's got us hung up on one model home per 20 lots, which is crazy. In the inventory situation we're in, we could pull 30 permits tomorrow and you're telling us we could build
That's a good topic.
Just the issue that's
come up. I think it's time. Good topic. This kind of segues into topics for next month because we don't have any. So
There is a just real quickly. It's a great topic, and I ran into this a couple of years ago. There's a stormwater hitch to this too that I think I have to relook. I have it on file. I ran into it, but your stormwater facilities. I know that. I believe that's one thing that has to be put in.
You have to have those in.
You know, it kind of makes sense, but there is a hitch to that a lot of stormwater facilities aren't able to go in and work. But that is something that by code and probably through DOE and everything that the stormwater facility has to come in.
Has to come in before what?
Has to come in before you can start issuing permits. I believe maybe even the model home permit.
Yeah. Your code would allow you to pull permits when you have your sewer water in, your curb line rocked, and maybe up to the last lift of pavement.
Yeah.
I think the best subdivision is when you wait till the last lift of pavement when most of your homes are done, then you put the top lift on and you got a nice new road that's not screwed up by all the contractors' rigs and landscaping, dump trucks, but that's just my personal preference.
But
not that you would do anything like that.
But that ties into what I think I heard, though, is as long as we have, because obviously it's going to, you're not going to have, if your stormwater permit requires soil amendments and things like that, you will never get them in.
No, that's not to pull permits. That's for occupants.
Okay.
My the stormwater part?
Soil amendments.
Soil amendments required.
So I'd be glad to look at our model home code.
I think it's worthy of a look.
So what I thought I heard you say was if you've got an approved engineered stormwater plan, as long as it meets the requirements flow requirements, well, that soil amendment may or may not be required.
It depends on any given site.
You have to have your stormwater facility installed, and then you build your homes, and then as part of the home construction, and we look at the soil amendment on individual lots, whether that's the LID or the feasibility. That feasibility says this is what how you do it is with soil amendment, or the new code requires soil amendment. That's not holding you up from getting a permit because it happens at like final grade, final inspection. That doesn't prevent us from saying you can have a building permit to build a home.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Marty, next month, lot home. Are you good?
No, I'm not good.
Adding to the
I'm agenda. Not. I will. Okay. We will look at it, and I will assign somebody to.
Okay.
I will not be the in country.
You can delegate.
You won't delegate.
You can delegate.
No delegate.
You're honest.
What?
I'm not gonna be that guy.
No.
It's gonna get done.
John,
we'll correspond on the model home. Ordinance.
The only thing I really have is what Pat Jeffries said, is that the builders have homes and inventory, which there's different stages. There's ones that are in the permitting now, there's ones that have been permitted, there's ones that are about to get final occupancy, whether it's tomorrow or 6 months from now. And there's a lot of confusion of what we have employees that navigate through this stuff. As of last Friday till today, it's been a spin zone for them. And that's what I was talking to Jim about out there, and he said the same thing. People really left that meeting because it got heated. Okay? So now, as this meeting's over, I'm still a little confused at what you can and can't do. If it's by a per lot basis, per subdivision basis, per rural lot, we all come in here individually and did what, you know, like Urban did earlier today and meet him individually, or do we come out with some kind of a blank statement so people know? Because I know what I'll do. I'll do what we have to do. And I'll have people down here taking up your time. See, that's what I'll do. And I'll be ahead of the curve, and I guess where I'm at is I am ahead of the curve, and I'm still confused.
I think that just one thought, because there's a ton of people here, and it was Friday into the agenda,
yeah.
But I think the one suggestion I would have is the simple vesting, if there is such a thing, on what topics are off the table for that topic versus those that need further discussion, because it was unclear to me. It felt to me like there were some things that could be black and white, but they weren't articulated about these are not topics, but I'm that's my perception.
I'm no different than anybody here. I'm running a private sector versus the public sector. I'm managing. And so when there's a lot of fur flying, I have to look in the mirror and say, what did I do to create this? And I don't know how this thing got implemented. I don't really know the details of what happened Friday. But I do know this. It's confusing. Our people are going to our clients. I told them to stop till the smoke settles. There's certain dollar amounts they want to prepare our clients to write checks for. Some of them don't have the ability to do it. So I'd at least like to somehow, I don't know how this committee comes or the timing of it all, but it seems to me we better do something quick to at least settle it a little bit, and then maybe if we're going to implement something here, have a better understanding. It's confusing as all get out.
What do you think, Marty?
Well, there was a lot of discussion about which version of the stormwater code applies 385 or 386.
Right.
If your 2012 subdivision under the 385 stormwater ordinance, your feasibility included soil amendment, then we're going to be testing and inspecting for soil amendment.
Yes, of course.
But if it didn't, if you didn't need soil amendment as a means to manage stormwater, then we're not going to inspect for that.
I think that's what Eric was trying to make.
Well, he made a more blanket statement, but you have to understand that you still have feasibility. Well, there was feasibility requirements in 2009, probably before then. The feasibility requirements in a study said you need to do X, Y, and Z, and those were the BMPs,
yeah.
And one of those was soil amendment or rain gardens or whatever.
and that's what was approved, that's what we're going to inspect.
When did we start putting those in plans?
2009 was soil amendment as a BMP.
So here's what happened.
In plans, though?
Yes. In 2009, Ecology and the old phase one EPA permit required them to be studied as design items that you had to consider as part of the implementation of your stormwater plan. And the Enviro sued, they wanted a hearings board decision that said, no, you need to mandate those things first before you go to other BMPs like stormwater, traditional stormwater detention facilities. And so beginning in 2012, those items were mandated, and for going forward is you had to study whether they're feasible or not feasible. And if they're not feasible, then you don't use them, and you use the alternative performance standard, however you're going to do that. And so I think there's some critical data issues that need to be resolved there, but it shouldn't take like 2 months to figure that out.
And we don't need a committee to figure that out.
Can I just a couple of questions? Marty, do you see a need to add clarification to this topic? And B, and second question, do you think the clarification would be on a case-by-case basis? For example, John comes in, or do you want to do it, three, on a general basis?
We should treat these, if Jeff is building in subdivision A, and John's building in subdivision B, they may have two different stormwater
plans. Totally, I understand that. I'm just asking.
His may require a soil amendment. His may not.
I understand.
So we have to treat these individually.
Okay, so individually, case by
case.
Yes.
Okay. So that's an easy thing to get out there. Right now, that's not the case. And then you have, like, in our case, we have our own business model. These other guys have theirs. But in our case, we could be in subdivisions, a hybrid deal with a recorded rural lot subdivision, or you can be on a raw tax lot. Now, how do you navigate through that? It is Jim, who do we talk to on a case-by-case basis? I think that would be something we can do.
So when you're talking subdivisions, the engineer of record should have?
Subdivision is pretty easy.
Yeah. Tax lots are a different matter. You probably have to talk to, tax lots that require new stormwater, those are going to fully engineered plans and development engineering. Greg's group.
That stormwater, I'll look at that. Does that require amended soils or not? I don't know.
And I'd say the same on that with the case by case. Start with Ali. It's a great start there, and I think he'll definitely help you to navigate through that.
Maybe something a subcommittee could do is, at least from my standpoint, I'm pretty involved in all our developments, but I don't know exactly. I mean, would I find these BMPs and the study in construction plans, conditions of approval from the preliminary plat, the TIR, I mean, where most likely the TIR?
Most likely the plans, but it's probably going to be a current limit.
Comment?
Be a note.
Just a small note somewhere.
Yeah, it seems like that would make a major note. 3 lines.
See, if we can, I mean, if it's 3 lines we're looking for, we kind of educate ourselves on what it is we're looking for. I mean, we might be able to pull some subdivisions in and out. You know, to get some things off the plate.
Well, I think Eric's point is well spoken, that there's kind of two paths to compliance. There's a prescriptive and there's...
One thing that might have helped, you might want to revise your pamphlet. You know, this only came across my desk on Friday, too. I didn't know anything about it. So I went to Snohomish County's notice that they give out on this, and theirs is quite detailed, and it's, you know, I think it probably might have answered a few more questions than what Clark County put out. I mean, because the Snohomish County notice talks about performance standards. And
I have their handout.
Yeah, and it seemed just to be a little more thorough and might have addressed a few more questions than what Clark County put out.
So for our
we're almost done. I know this is a long meeting. Topics for next month. We got one on that there. Any other topics for next month? We'll close it out.
Yeah, I noticed in the paper yesterday there was an emergency ordinance placed on transportation related issues that flowed from a hearing last week that I think we should bring up. We'll also have more details about that.
So we'll add that too.
Yeah.
So who will lead that up then?
I can lead
Jamie? Okay.
I can help.
Everybody can help. We'll get some information, I think, from some traffic engineers, too.
We can all help. It's not one that's right or wrong. I think it's, to me anyway, it was more in how it was handled in the presentation. But,
yeah.
I mean, it's a policy issue from the county, whether it's right or wrong. I think we need to look at it. I think Steve Schulte might have some insight into that. If he's still around, he would be willing to provide some insight, whether or not it was a
thumbnail.
Was that?
Sorry, what's the thumbnail on that?
The thumbnail is that the allegation was made or whatever that under the concurrency ordinance, you've got exemptions, one of which is the B over C ratio being less than 0.9, and there's a couple others in there. And two subdivisions went through Hinton and ours. Hinton didn't trigger it at all, I don't believe. They were completely level of service E. Ours was a 122 lot subdivision. 118 lots triggered level of service E, so we met. Four lots triggered level of service F, and we used the B over C ratio, and we were told, we were lambasted during the hearing since then from other places and people and whatever, and in the paper, as it being a loophole, you know, we drove a, this is a loophole, it's a loophole you can drive a freight train through. I mean, it was not, I mean, it was, they're saying it's supposed to be a for short plats and ma pas and things like that. Well, I've been around this county long enough to know that if that was the intent, that would have been limited. We've limited sizes of buildings, we've limited, I mean, that was the intent, Ron Barker would have been all over it, and planning and the council would have been all over it. But I don't know. But long story short, it's just now an emergency ordinance. It was overreaction on my part, from my standpoint. No one talked to me about our side of the story, and an emergency ordinance was passed.
And it was misrepresented in the paper.
Yeah, we're painted as the bad actors that did loopholes, and now we're going to be killing people.
And we all know the efforts that it takes to get any code placed on the books.
County staff did a fantastic job on here, and I'll say that. The county staff said that there's absolutely no safety issues. I mean, all these people testifying about all these people that are dealing with safety issues. This is absolutely having to do with connectivity or modal, whatever, traffic movement and directional movement. The bridge out there changed things. The ADHD bridge, fifth lane creek bridge. That's what changed it.
Why is it?
Traffic report. Once that went in, directional movements changed. The traffic changed out there. New traffic reports. That simple. But then we jumped to emergency ordinance.
And I think it goes beyond that too. I think it's whenever something like this comes up, all of a sudden the county thinks, oh my gosh, there's a loophole. There's an issue here. We need to get right in front of the counselor so that we can get this taken care of, at least initially, so that we can really fix it later. But why was it there to begin with? Nobody thinks of that. I mean, it was there for a reason, and it went through, gosh, PC, it went through the board, it started somewhere with staff. And so when you see stuff like that, when I see stuff like that, unless it is truly a loophole that you could drive a truck through and everybody notices that, and staff would say, oh, well, yeah, gosh, that was really, that's just, something that happened to slip through. That's what one of the things this board is for, is to fix things like that or to propose changes so that that does or doesn't happen again. So
we need to look at it. It's been on the books since 2010, at least, maybe earlier.
Yeah.
And the prosecutor's office, through emails, is noted as being well aware of it, and has always agreed until now, where they think a huge subdivision came through, which it didn't, four lots. The Maupaw short plat deal did four lots. And I'm sticking to it, and I can tell I'm not really happy with it. County staff did great.
Yes, David Jardine.
David Jardine did an awesome job. I told him afterwards, he really stuck to his guns. It was an ugly hearing.
Mm.
Yeah. So, anyway.
Sorry, I missed it.
You were there.
Sorry, I missed it.
I mean, I've never heard people yelling out behind me. I've never heard the get the rope.
Oh,
really?
Comment. No.
Jeez.
Anyway, it was fun.
That sounds like a lively discussion. I will be missing that. But
I don't know how lively. I guess I'll get it. Well, then I will put on that mic.
We'll get stuff together and out so everybody's fine.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm not good about it.
We are adjourned. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Oh,
Yeah. You heading out of Dodge a little bit?